your own kid, be the last down. That's always joy right here, deep in my heart. Well, we are kind of switching gears, but not totally. As we've been going through something called the story this year, looking at the overarching story of the Bible, in order to make sure that we get Easter on Easter weekend, we're going to, in Advent week one, continue through the story. And we're going to be looking at Ruth this morning, and Randall, who's been with us for, what now, about a year and a half? Ish around there. Randall, if you don't know Randall Benbow, he heads up our small groups here. He is a phenomenal young man, just had his first child, him and Nicole, this week. Not like yesterday, but yeah. This summer, August 21st?
No, July 6th.
That's what I said. Who's August 21st? Stephanie. That's Julia and, anyway,
that's okay.
Another couple we know. All right. Anyway, I've just really appreciated Randall, and it was really a miracle that he even came to us because he had no former contact. It was through Claren Martin, our regional minister, paired us up and thought this would be a good place to do an internship to learn how to pastor, since we didn't have a hired lead pastor at the time. So, so I think it's worked out well for us, and hopefully it's worked out well for you. Would you welcome as he comes this morning?
All right, good. Well, thank you very much, Jeremy. We on? We picking up? Yes. Yeah, it's been a pleasure. Yeah, Claren recommended it because of you, Jeremy. He said you would be a good mentor. So, you know, that's a little encouragement for yourself, too. And he has been. So, yeah, I just want to thank you today. I'm happy to be here, and I'm happy to share a little bit of the story and more of this journey with you here. I want to begin first by just sharing a passion and an interest of mine. I love nature. I love reading about it. I love being in it. I just enjoy immersing myself in, you know, National Geographic magazines and different sort of things just to learn about it. And part of my passion is also just being passionate about the different environmental issues of our time. I find it incredibly tragic when land that was used by humans becomes so desolate. It's used in such a mismanaged way, I'll use that word, that it just becomes unusable for decades, generations. You think of Chernobyl, the plant in, I think it's Ukraine now. But still to this day, people can't live around there because the reactor's still hot. And it'll be hot for our lifetime and lifetimes to come. It's kind of a scary thing. But Chernobyl's an extreme case. There's a lot of situations where land is used in a very extreme way, very desolate kind of way, but it can be restored. It can be reclaimed. And I'm fascinated by this idea of large-scale restoration because, or there's, you know, I'm fascinated by when they take place, and they take place around our world. People work. It takes a lot of people, a lot of organizations, governments to make it happen. The idea being to restore the land to its proper state for humans to maybe use again or to just, you know, it to be some sort of nature reserve or something like that. What I find very fascinating about God's creation is that there's nothing that survives on its own. There's so many things that are interconnected. You remove one species from an ecosystem and it can destroy the entire ecosystem. You remove a plant, you change the course of a river, and things can collapse very quickly. The way God designed it, everything was designed to rely upon each other for survival. So when one thing becomes unstable, everything can collapse. In North America, before Europeans came and settled the continent, there were millions upon millions of bison. They wandered the plains, and they were plentiful everywhere. And along with bison, there were deer, elk, pronghorn, all sorts of things that were wandering the prairies in North America, all the way from Mexico, all the way up to Manitoba, Saskatchewan, Alberta. Now, as most of you know, the bison herds were decimated. They were hunted for sport, for pleasure, because people figured they would never be gone. They would be there forever because there were so many of them. And so what was once millions and millions of animals was reduced to a few hundred individuals. Now, the fallout of losing the bison was a loss of grasslands. Now, initially, Europeans, as they settled into this land, they farmed the land and they settled everywhere across it. And so much of the land became farmed, but there were still some areas that were left natural and wild, but there were no bison anymore. Now, to this day, much of the land is still farmed. Much of it still worked, but there's more and more that's being lost every year throughout North America. I read a stat that there were up to 40% of the North American prairies are undergoing a process called desertification. It's where the land is no longer becoming farmable, no longer can it even support life because it's turning into deserts. And so this once fertile soil that somehow supported all these animals in the past, now we can't even farm. It's useless almost. Scientists have long blamed ranchers for their overgrazing and have often called for a reduction of herds to try to break this cycle of desertification. But even doing that, the land still got worse. A scientist by the name of Alan Savory, he grew up in Africa, and he believed that this was how to save the grasslands in Africa. And so he called for the elimination of 40,000 elephants back in the 1960s. Like, that is a lot of elephants. But he figured they're eating a lot of food. They're probably the reason that desertification is happening. So they removed the animals, but it didn't help the process. And it didn't make sense. They said, well, the elephants are gone. Shouldn't the grass just be there? It's growing, etc. So he had to stop. He had to refigure things. And so he looked at nature. He was in Africa, so there were still many large herds and wild herds present. And he noticed that, unlike farms, the herds never stayed in one spot at the same time. The herds were constantly on the move. There were lions, etc. in Africa. In North America, many of the species along the prairies were extirpated. Many of the predators, like wolves and a lot of bears, were killed, and cougars and such. So when they set up the Yellowstone National Park, they wanted to bring the bison back. So they brought bison back. And they did very well. They grew and they multiplied, but the park still seemed out of balance. It didn't seem right. Some plants weren't doing very well, which should have been doing well, what they understood about how it used to work before settlers came. And so they realized that the herds weren't moving around. They just kept eating their favorite plants. And since they kept eating their favorite plants, those plants started to, you know, lose energy. They started to just die off. And so eventually they persuaded authorities and such to bring back wolves to Yellowstone Park. All of a sudden the predators couldn't exactly stand, or the herbivores couldn't exactly stand still anymore, because the predators would quickly get them. The wolves would snatch them. And so immediately the park was transformed, and that small bit of wild nature was restored. But what about farmlands? There's a lot of farmlands. There's a lot of land that could support people and once did, but now doesn't. And so Alan Savory thought he would try to mimic nature with cattle, with livestock. And so instead of leaving the livestock in this, you know, fenced-in pen or fenced-in ranch or land, they decided to try to rotate them, move them, so they weren't constantly eating the same favorite grasses all the time. They were allowing the land to rest, allowing it to recover. And so he started to put this into practice, and so he turned what was very barren land, very desolate, into a grassland that's mostly recovered. And he's done it with his techniques have worked in millions of acres across all sorts of continents, working here. And what I love most about this, it's not just restoring nature, but it's allowing people to start living again. It's providing jobs for people. It's providing food for people. And when there's food and there's jobs, especially in Africa, there's less war. It's a very exciting thing to see what his work has been doing. Restoration's a beautiful thing. I like to see it in nature, but it's a beautiful thing in our lives when it happens. And it's a powerful theme that runs through the story of Ruth. The chapter is called The Faith of a Foreign Woman. In the scriptures, if you're reading it, you'll find it in the book of Ruth. She has her own book. But let me catch you up on where we've been the last few weeks so that we can start, we can all start on the same page this morning. So a couple weeks ago, we learned about Joshua. He had taken over leadership of the nation of Israel, succeeding Moses. And Joshua led his people into the promised land, and they conquered towns, and they conquered kings. But they didn't conquer all of Canaan. They didn't have the population, as God had said, and they also did just, some of them didn't have the drive to keep pushing. And now, what should have been where should have been the Israelites and the Canaanites outside the Israelites established land, it wasn't completely that. They had intermingled a little bit with the Canaanites. They had made a treaty with one group, and they never quite killed all of them as they were commanded to do by God. And so as time goes on, Joshua passes away. We move into the book of Judges. That was the last week's chapter, which was a few good men and women. And so judges rise. These are leaders appointed by God to bring them back to him. But in this book of Judges, we also see the lowliness of Israel's sin, how far they've fallen, because they've stopped always looking to God, and they've started intermingling with the Canaanites, just as he had warned them against, and they start adopting their pagan and idol worship. So during this time of Judges, the story of Ruth takes place. Now, before we come to any conclusions about this story, I want to first say something to the men. This is not a romance story, guys. Like, let's not write it off as this is a story for the women today. We can kind of just check out. It's not. The book of Ruth was put in the scriptures for a reason. Her story has been told for a reason. God had somebody write it down so that we would know about it. So let's try to listen and hear what God is doing in this story, and so that he can speak into our lives. So the story begins by telling us that there is a great famine in the lands. And it begins by saying that that the life of Ruth and Elimelech and Naomi are taking place during the time of Judges. So Elimelech and his wife Naomi, they had two sons, and they flee Israel because the famine is so bad. I mean, stop and think about that for a moment. This is all in the introduction of the book of Ruth. They go to the land of the Moabites to find relief. It's ironic, isn't it? God had just brought them into the promised land. He brought them into the land that's supposed to be flowing with milk and honey. It's supposed to be fruitful. It's supposed to provide for them in every aspect of their needs. But God had said back in Leviticus, back in Deuteronomy, that if the Israelites disobey, the land won't always produce for them. Curses will fall upon them. And so the Israelites have disobeyed as a nation, and the land is less prosperous. So they go to an enemy's territory, a neighboring state who they fight with from time to time. At this time, they're at a moment of peace. But this family goes to find relief. And so it should tell us that something is broken between God and the nation of Israel. So while there, Elimelech and Naomi's two boys marry Moabite women. What then happens is Elimelech and his two sons both die. They obviously had not been married or been settled in this land very long, because neither Ruth or Orpah had produced any heirs. And so it left three women widowed. With no kin in Moab, Naomi decides that she will return home. She will return to Israel. And she recommends to her daughters to stay. They're Moabite women. They wouldn't readily be accepted into Israelite culture. Their enemies, God had said, don't intermarry with them for 10 generations when they first found out about the Moabites. Obviously, this time it passed, but there would still be that prejudice, still be that racism against the Moabite people. And Naomi tells her daughters to also stay because under normal Israelite law, if Naomi had another son, that son would marry either one or both daughters to keep them protected, keep them in the family. But with no male relative, with no sons, Naomi tells her daughter-in-laws to stay. So Orpah decides to stay, but Ruth, on the other hand, remains loyal. And she says a pretty remarkable statement. She says, "Your people shall be my people, and your God shall be my God." Back in the Old Testament, the Israelites were the only ones who were God's people, but God wrote it into the law that foreigners, that aliens, as some different translations will call them, can be accepted into the Israelite community. And so it's a very striking thing which she says, "Your people shall be my people." She wants to identify herself with the Israelites. And by doing so, she wants to identify herself with God. She wants to abandon the tradition of her ancestors, her descendants, and she wants to follow God. There must have been something pretty amazing about Elimelech and his two sons that made her want to do this. And so she risks prejudice, she risks racism and isolation to go with Naomi. As the story progresses, Ruth asks Naomi if she may go and glean the fields belonging to Boaz, a kin of Naomi who is obviously wealthy enough to have fields and servants. What is amazing about this story, and it never, you have to know what's happened in the past, you have to know some of the Israelite law to understand some of these significant things which occur in this story. So Ruth asked to go pick in the fields, and this exemplifies something about God's law that he gave the Israelites, which really demonstrates his mercy. God stands up for the poor. He grants them opportunity to glean what harvester had missed or what they left behind. This is the command God gave to the Israelites. "Now, when you reap the harvest of your land, you shall not reap to the very corners of your field, nor shall you gather the gleanings of your harvest, nor shall you glean your vineyard, nor shall you gather the fallen fruit of your vineyard. You shall leave them for the needy and for the stranger. I am the Lord your God." It's a fairly amazing thing, right? I don't think many nations would have a law such as this to try to protect the needy and the poor in their society. And yet God, as he's trying to set up the nation of Israel, gives them a law that says, no, you will not ignore the poor. You will not ignore the needy. Anyone who owns land, who harvests that land, will not harvest all of it. Because some of that is for the poor. Some of that is to support those around you that have lost their land or don't have any land, or as a foreigner, such as Ruth. So Ruth begins working in the fields, and she catches the eye of Boaz, and she finds favor from him. He instructs his servants to leave strands behind for her to pick, and tells his servants to protect her. I mean, things could not be working out any better for Ruth right now. She took a great risk to go and pick on her own, go and pick among other foreigners, among other poor people. But out of desperation, she had to go support her and Naomi. So it's becoming more and more apparent that Boaz does seem to have a liking for Ruth. And so Naomi tells Ruth that she must go to Boaz, and at night, and while he is sleeping, uncover his feet and lie down at his feet. Every time I read this passage, I kind of pause there. I'm like, that is the weirdest thing. Right? Like, that's so different. I mean, who has a teenage daughter here? Like, just hands up. Who has teenage daughters? If your daughter came with a plan because they really liked a boy and were like, they had dreams of marrying this boy, they said, "I'm going to go lie at the foot of his bed and uncover his feet. It'll be fine. Don't worry about it." You're going to ground that daughter. You're going to make sure she never leaves the house for the next 2 or 3 years, probably. Right? Like, it's a pretty strange thing. But the notion presented by Naomi is not scandalous at all. The Bible doesn't, like, dance around issues. When something's graphic, it writes about it. So if there was something that was scandalous going on, it would let us know. The notion presented here, though, is actually an appeal to the Levirate Law, also known as the Kinsman Redeemer Law. The law was in place to, again, protect widowed women. Women who would be undesirable, who would be oppressed in a society because they aren't the virgins that young men would want to marry. So again, God gives this command to the Israelites. If brothers dwell together and one of them dies and has no son, the wife of the dead man shall not be married outside the family to a stranger. Her husband's brother shall go into her and take her as his wife and perform the duty of a husband's brother to her. and the first son whom she bears shall succeed to the name of his dead brother, that his name may not be blotted out of Israel." See, God is protecting the family name. God is protecting the widow, that she would still remain a part of the family. The custom, yes, would not be practiced here, but it's the custom to protect the oppressed, to protect the needy and the widows. So Boaz wakes up in the middle of the night. Again, if I were sleeping and I woke up, you know how you wake up sometimes and you almost think you see somebody there, and it's like makes you jump up and startle, and you're like, "What is going on? Who's in my room?" And most of the time, nobody's there. But what if somebody was actually there? Maybe some of you have kids, you know, who have nightmares and walk in, and they all of a sudden are standing right there in your face, and when you wake up, probably pretty startling. But Boaz takes it in stride. Ruth asks him if he would use his garment to cover his maid, an act that would signify he had intentions of marrying her. So Boaz covers her, symbolizing his protection over her and completing the part of the kinsman redeemer initiation process. So the two parted before nightfall. Maybe it was because they didn't want to seem scandalous, so they made sure nobody noticed them walking out of the building at the same time. And Boaz then had to approach the one who was actually entitled to be the kinsman redeemer of Ruth. That person had a closer relation. So the relative who is closest to Naomi in relation is invited to sit down with Boaz. He gathers elders before him, as elders act as witnesses. And Boaz asks this man if he wants to purchase the land from Elimelech. This man initially says yes. He looks at it as an opportunity to gain some more land, to improve his wealth. But when Boaz tells him that the land comes with Ruth, the Moabitess, he declines. It's not entirely clear why he declines. Some people suggest that possibly he didn't want to take the time necessary to try to first produce an heir for Elimelech and then also produce his own heirs through Ruth. Who knows what his age was, but that is a possible explanation of why he declines. So the man declines, paving the way for Boaz to fulfill the kinsman redeemer law. And Boaz knows this risk. Boaz already has land, but he also has a love for Ruth, an affection for her. And so it's not just him fulfilling the kinsman redeemer law, but he also gets to be with the woman he loves. And he therefore redeems Ruth. And then at the very end, we hear the entire point of this story or this book within the scriptures. It said, "Ruth, who gives birth to a son named Obed. Obed fathers Jesse, who fathers King David." See, in the lower story, down here, God restores the life of Ruth and Naomi. Her faithfulness to him is rewarded, and she is redeemed. Her faithfulness to God, that is rewarded, and she is redeemed, and she is made whole. She has become part of the Israelite community and now can worship God. God brings restoration to Elimelech's family as well. The land will stay in their possession. And the lower story is pretty easy to interpret. It's the one we often focus on and see. Ruth is the heroine, and she is saved by her hunk Boaz, right? Good romance novel, which is why men sometimes just tune this one out, right? But Ruth is in the Bible not because God needed to write a romance novel. It's in the Bible because of the upper story, what God is doing up here, what he's saying about himself, and what he's planning. So I want to touch on three points of who God is and how we can learn from him. The first point we need to understand about the upper story is that when this event happened, it happens during the time of Judges. I brushed past it really quickly at the very start of the sermon, but think about that. The time of Judges, the time where Israel and God's relationship is at its lowest point since God has founded this nation. They've turned to idol worship, and they've done some pretty crappy things. And so you might come to the Bible, though, as you're reading it, and I kind of took a snapshot of just an electronic version of the Bible here, and it ends with, the book of Judges ends with, "In those days, there was no king in Israel. All the people did what was right in their own eyes." So you hear that, you read that, and you're like, yeah, like that's the problem. And so then we have the story of Ruth, and we almost subconsciously, we almost ignore that in the days when the judges ruled, that's what the next line is. We almost just go to the fact that, oh, this must have happened after the judges, because this is where God is setting up his future king. Ruth is his great-grandmother. But the upper story tells us differently. It tells us something about God's character. There was no king in the time of Judges, the time when their relationship was broken, Israel's relationship was broken with God. But God was setting plans in motion so that when Israel was ready for a king, he had the man in place that he wanted. So that first point, God is a God who works in the chaos. He works when things don't make sense. He's always on the move. Second point that we want to learn, that we can take from this, is that God is a God who looks for the well-being of all people. There are several examples within the story of Ruth that tell us how God protects those who are impoverished. God protects those who are oppressed. And it's written within the law in numerous places, and that's just two examples out of there. But what does that have to do with us? I like to point that out because sometimes we don't understand the connection between Jesus, who we see in the New Testament, and God, who we see in the Old Testament. You know, we look at Judges, we look at Joshua, where, you know, there's a lot of war, it's nations are setting up. And we miss the point of who God is sometimes. In the story of Ruth, God's law is exemplified perfectly. It demonstrates that the Israelites are practicing God's law. They are leaving harvest on the field for the poor to pick. Because even knowing if they may want to keep it because they may want to reap all the harvest and earn as much money as they can. But God's commanded it because he wants them to look out for the poor. He wants to write it into the very fabric of the nation that you will be a people who not only just celebrate wealth, but you also look after the needy. You will not leave people behind. You will not leave fellow Israelites behind. As we connect that to today, we need to keep doing things in our church, such as the Christmas dinner, what's coming up. We need to keep making inroads into our communities because there are a lot of people who are in need, who have no other help, but we can offer it. Together, we can put finances together. Together, we can make meals. Together, we can help people out of tough situations. So even knowing we don't have the law like the nation of Israel did, we have the example set by Jesus that we are commanded to take care of the poor and the needy, to follow his example. The third and final point of the upper story that's communicated in this book is that our God is a God of restoration. God doesn't want to leave things broken. His plan is twofold. He was going to restore the nation of Israel to himself. They were without a king. And God put in motion, before the Israelites even had requested a king from him, that he would have somebody in place that he wanted to be king. On top of that, he also restores people. Ruth was an outsider, somebody from a different nation, but she was somebody who liked what she saw in Israel, who liked what she saw in God, and wanted to come to him. And again, within the law, God provides a way for foreigners to be a part of the Israel community so that they may worship him. Finally, when you look at who the kinsman redeemer is, I almost want to look at that as like a snapshot of who Jesus is for us. We are the outsiders. We are the foreigners. And yet Jesus provides this way to bring us into his community, make us a part of his church, to be the husband as we are the bride. He is a God who restores. He is a God who redeems. And he doesn't let anything get in the way of those willing hearts who want to come to him. So again, let's recap. What's our take home? God is at work in the chaos. When your life doesn't make sense, when it's you can't figure out what God's doing, he demonstrates in the scriptures, and I hope at some points in your life he has demonstrated that he is planning things. Whether it's setting up relationships so that you can get a job one day, or meeting a future spouse that you don't even know you like each other till several years down the road. God is a God who works in the chaos. When things least make sense, God is still at work in your life. Secondly, our God protects the poor and the oppressed. So we need to too. It's part of our church's vision. Our church's vision is to love God, to love others, and to serve the world. I mean, that's a very simple version of it. But that's what we're called to do. That's what we need to live out. We need to be asking ourselves, are we following God's will in our lives? Are we doing this? Last but not least, God is a God of restoration. You may have come here today and you may not have really paid attention to the sermon, didn't really connect with anything else in the service, and you're maybe wondering why you came. And I hope that this last thing is for you, that God wants to restore the emptiness you feel. He wants to restore the brokenness you feel because he wants you to have a close relationship with him. So I want to just provide an opportunity just right now just for us to pray. I'll leave a bit of silence for you to just come to God. It's for all of us. We all need restoration each and every day. We all sin. But it can be especially important for some people to do this right now. So let's pray and I'll close us off. God, we thank you that whatever you will is going to come to pass. And we know, God, and we trust that it's your will that we would be in close communion with you. That we would be in close communion with our church family. And that you want to restore us. God, I pray that you would provide restoration for each person here today. That your Holy Spirit would rebuild relationships and just rebuild love. God, we just praise you and we thank you.